supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY.
Welcome to Common Space. I'm Jamie Jay, Executive Director of First Person Arts, and this is a place where real-life stories speak to the pressing issues of our times.
You need respect like everybody else, you know, like any other man, any white man, black man, whatever, you know. I'm a man. Treat me right.
I'm Jamie Jay. And, you know, recently I came across a photo from the civil rights movement of the late 60s. It's iconic. It shows a demonstration with a large group of black men standing in dignified silence and holding signs that simply say, "I am a man." As I look across this photo, it's of sanitation workers in Memphis, I see working men of all ages. Men not unlike my granddaddy or my uncle, on strike for better working conditions. Stone-eyed, determined men, holding signs that tell the world what it should have been able to see with its own eyes. I am a man. So we dug into the archives to find the voices of this moving event, which took place in the spring of 1968. A minute ago, we heard sanitation worker Ozell Yule asking for simple respect as a man and to be treated right. Now we'll hear from fellow striker Elmore Nickelberry, followed by the Reverend James Lawson.
Most of the time they would call us old stinking garbage man. That's all they called us. You had people on the street calling that. Yeah. But I know that I wasn't no garbage man. I was a man. And that's when I went on the strike, because I was a man.
When a public official orders a group of men to get back to work and then we'll talk, and treats them as though they are not men, that's a racist point of view. And no matter how you dress it up in terms of whether or not a union can organize, it's still racism. For at the heart of racism is the idea that a man is not a man.
Just 1 week after the sanitation workers' march, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Martin Luther King Jr. stood for a lot of things in his lifetime. But I can't help but feel like the timing of his assassination in Memphis, when he was there to offer sanitation workers his support, I can't help but wonder what impact that had on the struggle. What impact did his assassination at that time have on the movement, have on the work that would have to be done for years and years and years by black men? So I started wondering, what does it mean to be a black man today?
Being black is a job. It's a calling. It's a calling. And I don't think a lot of the people who look down on African Americans could walk a day in our shoes.
That's Russell Walker. And he and a group of friends joined me for a roundtable at WHYY Studios to explore this business of being an African-American man today. Around the table was a doctor, an educator, an athlete, and a veteran. So on that same theme, here's the question I have. What was the moment, the first moment, that you realized that you were an African-American male and that meant something, good or bad? What was that moment for you guys?
I think my first experience started off when I was about 9 years old.
That's educator Mike Green.
I was born and raised in the city, and I would end up moving into the suburbs with my grandmother. And transferring to this school, I ended up being the only African-American male in my class. And I just remember just kind of being shocked. I mean, and it wasn't like there were conversations that, you know, my family was having and kind of breaking it down. And I may have not even understood at that time, but I understood at that point that, you know, I couldn't articulate it, but I'm like, wow, man, you know, there's something funny about this, or not even funny, but just uncomfortable just being, you know, I wasn't ashamed of being African-American, but it's just like being in an environment where you don't have anyone that looks like you. And then having to deal with, you know, the socialization in terms of, you know, playing with certain friends and, you know, not being able to do certain things, because it's a lot different playing with my African-American buddies in the city as opposed to being in the suburbs and playing with some of, you know, my white buddies. You know, I really started to pick up on things. And I think at that point, I really started to understand race a little bit. And, you know, my great grandmother, my grandmother at the time, they were alive. So, and I would hear them talk about certain things. And I'm like, wow, it became apparent to me that there was something going on that kind of had me, you know, really looking at race.
The first time I became race conscious or was conscious of race, I remember very distinctly I was in first grade. So you have to know I grew up in the 60s.
That's Dr. Arthur C. Evans, and he has a huge title. Commissioner of the City of Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disabilities Services.
I grew up in Florida, so this the South. I was in a segregated school. It was segregated 1 through 12. This was before busing had happened in Florida, at least this part of Florida. And I remember being in a first grade class, and the classroom that I was assigned to was too large, and so they had to separate the kids. And they were separating the kids that were a little smarter, I guess, from the kids that were going to be, I guess, the normal kids or the average kids. And I remember seeing a bright-skinned person get moved to the slower class or the average class, and it was jarring because at that point, at that age, I believed that if you were brighter skinned, that you were automatically a brighter person, because that's what was sort of ingrained. And you know, a lot of those images, even in the movies today, you still see that kind of imagery. But in the 1960s, that was very much ingrained. And so even at the age of 6, that had gotten in somehow. So I think the whole idea of race and race superiority and inferiority is very insidious, and it happens in ways that we're not even aware of. And it's one of those things that gets in our minds. And we, you know, from studies that even really small kids understand and can distinguish race at, you know, age of 2, 3.
Russell Walker, what was your experience?
I can't remember a time where I didn't know that I was a black male. My grandma, who is like one of the brightest black people you could ever meet, she was racist as I don't know what. She can't stand white people. And it may be because she came from that time, you know, that you did. So they have a different experience with white people than I had. But as I said, I've always known I was a black man. I've always known that there's kind of like a fine line of me being arrested, me being killed, me being treated less than in some way. But then my father moved us to South Philly. The school I went to, which was Abigailville Elementary, was like America was supposed to be a melting pot. This school had every black, white, Hispanic, Asian. We had everything in the school. So it was like that school, like it showed me something else. It showed me that there's a world where everything doesn't have to be about color. That was the early years of that school. Later on, there was a K through 8 school. So in about fifth grade, my best friend, who happened to be white, called me a nigger. So that at that moment, it was kind of like it's always there. Not that you can't trust people, but racism is never completely gone from people. You know, it's learned. He may not really dislike you, but he may have heard people use that word when they're mad at other people or when they think another person is beneath them. So, yeah, I've always known, you know, who I was and that I was a black male, and that in this world there are certain things that I gotta look out for more than other people, other males.
It's a family affair.
up to be somebody that just loves to learn. And another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn.
You know, children don't ask to come here. They don't control their environment, not who they're born to, nor who raises them. And we know from real-life storytelling and testimonials that the road to manhood for an African-American teen, even in the most stable of families, is sometimes filled with ominous twists and turns. But sometimes just one experience can be so profound that it changes everything. Journalist Mr. Man Frisbee told his story of one such experience at a First Person Arts live event.
My story begins on a very cold day in the winter of 1991. I lived in Richard Island Projects. Richard Island Projects, North Philly. I lived in Richard Island Projects when it was the projects. Now it's manicured lawns and cars and driveways, and it's public housing. I lived in Richard Island when it was the projects, and I went to a high school called Bodine at 4th and George. And you know how you try to be fly back in the day. This is 1991. I thought I was real fly. I had red K-Swiss. I had hammer pants. I was fly. But on this day, it was too cold for cute. This is one of the coldest days of the winter, like the hawk is out. So the little yellow puff that I normally wore couldn't rock the yellow puff. But the only problem is that my only other coat, you know, I kind of like jacked it up in a little project accident and pushed the fur against a light bulb. So I was a little bit too vain to be rocking a triple fat goose to Bodine all jacked up. So I didn't wear it for about a year. But the hawk on that day called for the triple fat goose, right? So I put on my goose and I'm rocking. I'm walking the bus. This is back when we had Walkmen before the iPads and all the little yellow ones. So I got my MC Light, my Big Daddy Kane. I'm rocking. It's 19 degrees, it's freezing. I'm hawking in my goose, my ankle goose. It was the trench, like self-destruction video trench. To all the young bucks, Google it, self-destruction, D-Nice. So I get to school, I get to Bodine, you know, I go to my locker, I put my triple fat goose in the locker, go to my first class. Everything's going well. Mr. LaRocca, the vice principal, comes and he says, listen, I need to take you out of class. Your godfather is here. He says it's an emergency involving your godmother. You need to come right now. Get your stuff, and you're going to have an early dismissal, right? So I grab the goose, grab my book bag. I come down to the first floor, and I see him, and I say, Snells, we call him Snells. What's up? What's going on? Like, what's going on with me, Francis? Come on, you got to go. It's an emergency. We walk out of the school, and we go to the car, which is parked right in front of the principal's window. So I'm looking up and see Mr. LaRocca is still checking us out, right? I get in the car and I say, what's the problem? You don't never wear that triple fat goose. It's hawking. I wore the goose. I know I normally wear the yellow puff. I wore the goose. What's up? So he grabs my sleeve and he pulls the coat off, pulls me out of it that way, at which time he pulls open the inside of the coat and it is totally and completely lined with cocaine. From collar of the goose all the way down to the bottom of the goose on both sides. When I tell you, like, my heart stopped because I'm just like, yo, what if this came out when I was stuffing it in my locker? And to take y'all back, you know, I lived in what they call now, and they glamorize it and glorify it, and they call it a trap house. And they make songs about it and make it seem like it was fly. It was nothing fly about it. That was my reality. My godfather was a drug dealer, and his friends were drug dealers. They used the kitchen table where I made turkey and cheese sandwiches to package drugs. So because I didn't wear the coat in a year, they basically used my coat to stash the drugs. They wasn't thinking about me or the goose. So now I'm sitting in this car. I'm furious because he was not the type of person who would have taken the rap for me had I got busted in school with all of this cocaine, right? And he says, you all right now. I bought your yellow coat. You can go back in the building. I said, dude, Mr. LaRocca is in the window right now. He's looking. I'm not getting out this car. Because what emergency did we resolve in 30 seconds? So I got out the car, as cold as it was, I remember being furious, like lava heat. And I got out, I slammed the door, I put my yellow puff on, I got my book bag, and I just start walking back to the projects. I was furious, and the epiphany that day was like, yo, dude, like you got all of these book smarts, and you get A's and B's, and you know how to talk and what to do, but you're really not paying attention. this situation that you're in is serious. Not long after that, you know, we were raided. He wasn't there that day. His partner was. And I remember, you know, because I did run track. I ran down the hall in my bedroom, slammed the door, the ironing board fell. And I remember the cop, like, trying to get through the door. And he was talking to me through the door. Of course, I'm paralyzed with fear. And I'm like, listen, I can't move because you're going to shoot me. He said, don't worry. Don't worry, bro. I know who you are. We've been watching this apartment for a long time. You come and go every day to school. You ain't hustling. I just need you to get out that closet. So not long after that, you know, I made a life decision. I transferred to Overbrook High School, mighty, mighty Overbrook, the home of the Panthers, because I've been a runner since 8 years old. And I said, you know what? I have to get back to that because this drug life, this trap life is not for me. I want to increase my chances of getting out of these Richard Allen projects and making it. So I said, maybe if I run fast enough, I'll get an athletic scholarship. And when I transferred to Overbrook, I was literally running for my life, putting those miles in, running the hills, doing the workouts, doing the stairs to try to get out. But what happened, Young Bucks, is in the course of doing that, all of the time management skills and all of that kind of stuff that comes along with being a student athlete, I was able to earn an academic scholarship, a full scholarship to Penn State. So my letter came to the, you know, Project Mailroom saying that you have a full scholarship. And even then, you know, with all I had been through and everything I was, like, pushing to do, it was like, yo, something has to give. I have to still have to figure out, you know, I'm in this situation. I got to think ahead of myself. So as a result, you know, I went to my counselor at Overbrook and said, how can I become a journalist? How can I make this happen? She put me in a program called Urban Journalism Workshop that was taught by reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News. So at 17 years old, I'm in this workshop. After that, they have a program called Fresh Ink where we wrote every week. Every Thursday, we had an article. So I was a published journalist in 12th grade, right? Living in the projects, coming from the projects to the Daily News, writing. And it helped me because all of those essays I wrote for college got the scholarship. When I graduated Penn State, I had an internship at the Daily News. I was the only intern they kept in the history of the newspaper. Immediately following my internship. So I was hired, 22 years old, running around the streets covering homicides, murder, entertainment, you know, trials, like crazy, crazy stuff. And I'm just like, yo, I was just in Richard Island like 5 minutes ago. And now I'm running to these scenes. And one of the things that I always take with me is like, you know, I learned a lot from my mentors. I learned a lot from them that, you know what, it's not about just academic stuff. It's not about what you're going to accomplish on paper. What kind of person are you going to be? And they said, whatever you do, all that kind of stuff can fade away. Jobs can change. But you want to be a good person. You want to be a decent person. And you don't want to leave the people that come behind you hanging the way you were. Thank you very much for having me.
You know, a crossroads in life offers more than one way through. Mister chose to take control of the things he could, and in doing so, he changed the trajectory of his entire life.
Let's go out to the hotline right now and welcome in a Temple University Hall of Famer. Played with the Owls from 1998 to 2001. And oh, yes, he won a Super Bowl championship with the Indianapolis Colts, and that is Raheem Brock. Raheem, Zach Gelb here on Temple's campus. Thanks for a few minutes. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Raheem Brock is sitting across from me in the studio, nodding his head in recognition. His road to becoming a Super Bowl champion, a brilliant defensive end for the Indianapolis Colts and the Seattle Seahawks, was paved with all sorts of interferences.
Growing up in Germantown and having to deal with living around the projects and, you know, trying to get to school and getting into fights, my mom would work morning to night, get home like 11 o'clock. So, you know, the streets pretty much was raising me. You know, I just sat on the corner with the older guys. I was in fourth grade, you know, drinking 40s and just chilling at the corner until, you know, one of my friends got shot at the corner and the drive-by was like right in front of my house. So it kind of changed things for me. So I was, you know, trying to get a little bit more focused and try to stay out of trouble. And went to high school, played ball, football pretty well in high school. But the teachers would, you know, constantly tell me, like, if you're not getting straight A's, you're not going to make it to college. So at some point, I was just like, I was going to be at McDonald's. So that was my mind just changed. Like, I'm just trying to be a manager at McDonald's now. And, you know, I was about to start my family. And, you know, I had my daughter. And I thought after high school, that was it. And then started getting letters in from colleges. And, you know, I got offers from different schools, Michigan, Syracuse, Rutgers. And I decided to stay at Temple because of my daughter was still here. And especially they had a great business program. So I decided to stay in Philly. And, you know, I was working like two jobs, playing football, did mentoring, and going to school and trying to and managing all that. Which, you know, while I was in high school, they said I wouldn't even be able to make it in college without having straight A's, which mentally just made me focus on other stuff. But when I got there, you know, I was making, you know, the dean's list and still being able to manage working and football and everything like that. So I kind of was upset at the whole situation in high school, at the teachers telling me that you're not going to be able to make it, or you're making me think that I'm not going to be able to go to college. So, and they got these entry-level classes they try to get you to take. I ain't take any of the classes. I took all advanced classes just to, you know, see where I'm at. I did good in those classes. So instantly I just had a whole different mindset of things. Like, my mind just started thinking, you know, I could do it. I still was trying to take care of my kids. So I was working at, you know, clubs. I had the, you know, guys trying to rob me from leaving, you know, the clubs and stuff like that. So I was still trying to fight through Philly to make my way out, which was tough for me. So, you know, I was doing good in college. The team, we didn't do that great. So we would go to the classes, and the professors would talk bad about us. So you didn't want to go to class anymore. If you're in a lecture hall full of, you know, 200 people, and you got a professor in there that's making fun of you, you know, every time you come in the classroom. So it makes you, you sat in the back in the corner, and, you know, it's frustrating. And but I still had to stay focused, and I was working hard, and, you know, I had a goal that I wanted to achieve. And, you know, I was able to, even though we didn't have that much success at Temple, I was able to get drafted 7th round. And I ended up going to Indianapolis. And, you know, growing up in Philly and being at Temple just gave me tough skin and that hard work ethic, that blue-collar work ethic that, you know, I wasn't going to be denied. I was going to do whatever I could. And if I didn't make it, I'm not going to be one of those guys that say, I should have did this, or I should have did that, or I wish I would have. I'm always going to be that guy. So, you know, I pushed myself to the limit. When I was in Indianapolis, I had 7 guys in front of me, including the first-round draft pick, which I beat everybody out that got drafted before me that year, and ended up starting my rookie year with Indianapolis, and had some great, successful seasons playing with a bunch of Hall of Fame, you know, guys, you know, just beating out the odds of a 7th-round draft pick from Temple, which is not, they don't expect anybody from Temple to make it.
Dr. Evans, you look ready to chime in on that one.
Something that is a result of the experiences that we have, I think one of them is tenacity. And I just see so many guys who are just tenacious. They're just hungry, whether it's, you know, they want to be a rapper, or they want to be a physician, or they want to be a lawyer, or they want to, you know, drive a bus. I've just seen so many guys who they just have that hunger because of the experiences that they've had. And I think that's good. I think that's a positive. It's like in sports, teams that are viewed as an underdog in a game, they really go after it, you know? And I think when you're viewed as an underdog, for whatever reason, I think it makes you more tenacious. I think it makes you more hungry. One of the things that I like, I guess there's no other way to say it, I just think that, you know, guys are cool. I think black men are cool. You know, you think about people like Sidney Poitier, you think about Barack Obama. I mean, they're just cool. I mean, despite all of the things that these men go through, and there are some universal experiences that you have as a man of color. Despite all of that, at the end of the day, you still can love people. You can still have great relationships. You can still, you know, work and want to be a good father and all those kinds of things. I kind of marvel at that. I think, you know, as an African psychologist named Naeem Akbar, and he says, rather than thinking about, you know, all of the negativity and all of the things that are wrong with African Americans, we really ought to be celebrating all the things that are right. You know, despite, you know, a history of slavery and Jim Crow and, you know, modern day discrimination, you know, majority of folks get up and go to work every day. They take care of their kids every day. They go to school. I mean, most people are still, despite all of the things that we've talked about, are doing well and are doing the right thing. You know, I didn't have a tough childhood. I didn't. I had a good childhood. But, you know, I marvel at guys who have had really difficult childhoods, things that most people would never go through, even as adults. And despite all of that, they still come out doing really incredible things. I just think that very inspiring.
It is inspiring. And it led to one of my favorite moments in our conversation when I asked if there was a song that brings that feeling to life. Check this out.
Denise Williams did a song called Black Butterfly. It's a very inspirational song and just talks about Black Butterfly and, you know, sort of the beauty in the Black Butterfly and you know, really using that as an analogy in terms of someone's life. And so I think, for me, that's a very inspirational song.
Black Butterfly, sail across the waters. Tell your sons and daughters what the struggle brings. I can't remember the next line.
I forget.
I love another lyric from that same song. It goes, a dream conceived in truth will never die. Brings me right back to that photo of the sanitation workers holding signs that say, I am a man. And their dream that America would someday see them for who they really are. Men. This is WHYY's Common Space. A place where real life stories speak to the pressing issues of our time. And we've been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. In the stories we shared here in the studio or at First Person Art Story Slams, men young and old spoke of this exhausting need to always be vigilant, on your guard, if you will. It seems that success, fame, visibility, awards, being a good worker and family man, doesn't make you immune to double standards. Dr. Evans, you describe this as sort of a tax.
And the best example for me is, I remember my wife is from the Bahamas, and I remember going to the Bahamas and spending probably over a week, you know, maybe 10 days in the Bahamas. And first of all, when you go to the Bahamas, it takes me about 2 or 3 days just to get to that pace, you know, Yaman, you know, the Yaman's pace. So when I get down to that pace, I'm coming back. I remember flying into Miami and I could feel myself tensing up. You know, at this point, I'm in psychology programs. I'm a little bit having a little bit of insight about that. And like, what is that about? Why am I tensing up on the airplane? And I was starting to think about what I was going to have to do when I got to the airport and who I was going to have to interact with. And the filters were starting to come back into play. And I think that that's what I think you mean by when you were talking about it's work. There's a level of filters that you have to have all the time, level of of screening of information that I didn't have to have when I was in an environment where if someone slighted me, I didn't have to try to figure out, well, why did they slight me? What could that have been about? You know, it could have been, okay, this person is a jerk, and I keep moving. In the U.S., you have to kind of like, okay, maybe it's not that, it's something else. And so you have to go through that process, and I do think that that can be taxing for a lot of people.
Mike Green.
It kind of makes me think about a few different things. I mean, you know, now, you know, we're living in this age where you have to be careful. So I kind of have gotten used to just kind of watching myself. It's like second nature. You don't even know that you're doing it, but you're kind of watching people. But, you know, then I'll have this moment where I think, well, look, I can't live like this every day and just be worried about so-and-so. You know, if it's my time, it's my time. But, you know, you have to kind of, you can't be naive about it. But it definitely forces you, you know, growing up in the city, you know, in terms of going out even into other communities, you kind of take that out into other communities. So, like, if I'm in the suburbs, I know that, you know, a certain mile per hour that I have to drive. And, you know, it's almost like within every environment, you really have to guard yourself and be careful what you do. And it kind of, it's like, in some ways, I guess, you're hypersensitive to everything.
Raheem, as a celebrity football player, I would think you have a unique perspective around this concept of double standards.
If I go into a restaurant, you know, I get treated a certain way until they find out who I am. Once they find out who I am, like, I play ball, I'm playing for the Colts, everybody changes. Like, everybody's attitude changes. So that kind of made me feel a certain way. Some of the things I saw on TV in Indianapolis, it was like Martin Luther King Boulevard in the hood. But once it got to the suburbs, it changed to Michigan Road. So on the news, they talked about changing this road to Martin Luther King all the way up into the suburbs. And it was all these people, you know, white people on TV just talking about Martin Luther King already has a day, that's all he needs, and just going in on Martin Luther King. Like it was crazy to see that on TV out there. It was, you know, it's people still getting hung out there and drugged down the street and all this racial stuff going on in Indianapolis. Well, Indiana, period, which was totally different than being in Philadelphia, coming from the city and then going out to Indianapolis and having to deal with something like that. And being in a restaurant where they won't seat you. We had to sit. I was in South Bend, and we sitting there for like 2 hours, and all the white people are coming in, they getting sat, and the person, I was with my son's mom at the time, her dad like just spazzed out, and I'm like, I can't believe this. I'm stuck in like the 50s or something like that. It was crazy. I couldn't believe anything like that was going on still, but it's still going on, and it's crazy to me. So. But, I mean, it's just, I don't know.
Raheem, now here you are in Indianapolis facing all of this racism, yet you're supposed to get on the field and bring home a Super Bowl championship ring for this place that is treating you that way. I mean, what is that about? How does that feel?
It's frustrating to see stuff like that still going on, because I never saw anything. I never experienced anything to that aspect. I mean, I've seen it all out there. Like, it was totally different from what I've experienced all my life, and I only saw on TV and movies. Even when now, I still get people acting a certain way. I live in a certain area. I know the white people may not like me or anything like that, but I'm going to be overly friendly just to try to break it and try to get them to be like, you going to talk to me? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't care if you know, what's up? How you doing? Hi. Like, I'm going to force it and just be overly friendly, try to, you know, get them out of it. I mean, it could be, I don't know what they're going through with their life or what their family has taught them as they grew up. But, you know, all I could do is try to be positive with me, because all the negative is inflated, like, with the social media and everything like that. So that's why I try to push, like, all the good that's going on in the world.
Russell Walker?
Something I read in one of the sociology classes is called code switching, which I think that's really stressful on people of color, not just black men, just on people of color, because you have to carry yourself a certain way in certain places because you don't want people to look at you, you know, think something about you. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be looked down on. So I think that's kind of a stressful thing to always have to do also.
This code switching, it's nothing new. In fact, Mike Green reminded us of what the scholar W.E.B. Du Bois said about it in 1903 in his seminal work, The Souls of Black Folk. First, here's Du Bois himself speaking in a vintage recording.
It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity.
W.E.B. Du Bois, I guess there's a term that he refers to, double consciousness. So if you work in a predominantly white institution, being a black male or a black female, you know, there's a certain way you have to carry yourself, and you don't want to be over aggressive because, you know, historically, you know, black men have been, I guess, interpreted or looked at as being, you know, aggressive in certain situations. So it's kind of hard. And then when you get back into the city, you have to kind of change into a whole nother person. It's like, so you're wearing all these different hats.
Right. One hat when you're in the neighborhood and another hat when you're in society in general. And a crucial part of it is to also be acutely aware of the threats that might surround you. Now, remember earlier, Mr. Man Frisbee told us his story about how a police officer shielded him from arrest during a drug raid on his family's house. But sadly, history, very recent history even, has taught us that police violence is an all-too-common threat to African-American males. And it's hardly a new thing. Richard Pryor talked about driving while black way back in 1974.
Cops put a hurting on your ass, man, you know. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over. Hey, officer, yes, glad to be of help. N***a got to be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license. Because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident.
We also know the presence of violence goes beyond interaction with the police. We do need to take a moment here to shout out some of the names of recent victims of that sad roster. Alton Sterling, Philando Castillo, Mike Brown, but there are others, other victims of non-police racial incidents, like Trayvon Martin, Joe McKnight, Jordan Davis, worshipers at Mother Emmanuel Church. And the list goes on and on and on.
Tyrone Riego, 50, Louisiana. Lafayette Evans, 37, Iowa. Sherman Evans, 63, D.C. Jermichael Kennedy, 22.
I'm Jamie Jay, and this is WHYY's Common Space, a place where real-life stories speak to the pressing issues of our time. We're supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. We're in the studio sharing some stories with fellows about their experiences growing up as black men. Now, no one wants to generalize, but it seems like confrontation and aggression are often just too close, even when some people don't really want to be violent or confrontational. This brings to mind a story told to us by Billy Smith at a first-person arts event about when he was a young African-American student attending Temple University. Here's Billy.
Lest you believe I came here dressed up for this occasion, it's not true. I'm an attorney by trade. I'm a criminal attorney. Yeah, you boo me now, but when you need me, you love me. But this story isn't about my criminal practice. It's about how me and a would-be criminal saved each other's lives. Let's take you back to 1992. I'm a freshman at Temple University. Hey, go Owls. It's not the bucolic, well-lit environment that it is today. It was dark. The squirrels had crack. It is midterms. I am trying to keep my scholarship. I'm at the library. It's 1 a.m, and yeah, there's a shuttle, and yeah, my girlfriend lives on campus, but I'm tired, and I just need to walk. I decide to leave. I walk out of the library. I saw it coming. I walk past the bell tower. what's now Aaliyah Court's walk. I'm walking down there. It's brick. There's trees. And I see one guy sitting on one academic building and another guy sitting on another academic building. Now, I'm from Colorado originally. I'd been in Philadelphia for about 4 years prior to that, so my spidey sense was a little off. And I realized a little too late that I was in a little bit of trouble. So as I'm walking down the mall, I see a kid walking towards me, no older than 14 or 15. I couldn't do nothing about it. He walks towards me. He gets about 5 feet away. He holds a nickel-plated 44 like this. I stand there, my life flashing before my eyes. He stands there, shaking like a leaf. He didn't want to be there. Now, we are in North Philadelphia, but I'm not going to entertain any stereotypes. So for purposes of this story, they could be Khalil and Jamal or Raul and Juan. I'm going to call them Biff and Moisha. Moisha had the gun. Biff was the heavy. So Biff is standing in front of me. Moisha standing in front of me shaking like a leaf. Biff is behind him. He runs up. Now, I'm from Colorado. And I have a bag. Believe it or not, I had hair. Had a little kid and play box. And Moisha says, in his shaky voice, "Give it to me, give it to me." Biff runs behind him. "What'd you get, son?" "I don't know yet," says Moisha. Still shaking. I say, "Listen, guys, I don't know where you guys went to the school of criminality, but you're robbing a black guy on a public school campus." Like, really? What do you think I have? I empty my bag, say, "You could sell these books. I've got a pick with a fist on the end of it. You can have that. Here's a meal card. You can have that. Just let me go." So then this weird dance occurs between myself and Moisha. Moisha says, "Wait a second. Hold your head up." Biff says, "Cap this bitch. Fuck him. Get your first body." Moisha says, wait, chill. "Yo, where do I know you from?" He's trying to save my life. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. That's the first thing that came to my mind. I was like, do you play basketball? Moisha says, yeah, I play ball. You play ball at Nice Town Boys Club? Now, people from Philly, Nice Town Boys Club doesn't have a court. I was just pulling it out of thin air. And he says, yeah. "What's your name again, son?" Khalil? "Yeah, cool. I can't rob this dude. Well, Biff isn't convinced. Nah, he's seen our faces, yo. You gotta cap him. Morris is like, nah, he's cool. Chill. Biff says, "How do you know him again?" I said, "I dunked on him at Nice Town Boys Club." Moisha goes, kind of punked him from his phrase, like, "You never dunked on me, kid." I was like, "Oh, all right, my bad. Somebody else. So long story short, I go back to my dorm after they allowed me to collect my stuff. And I did Moisha a solid. I could have called the cops. I could have had them canvass all of North Philadelphia to find this young man. But that young man wasn't a criminal. That young man was a boy who was hungry, a boy who lacked education, a boy who needed some guidance. And I wasn't going to be the one responsible for changing his life.
Growing up in his neighborhood, Russell Walker remembers a day that stayed in his mind. And as we shared stories, he reflected on how that experience helped him negotiate danger when he served in the military in Iraq.
So growing up in West Philly, there's not a lot of places to play safely. Our favorite sport was basketball. We couldn't always go down to the basketball courts, so we would we innovated ways to play on our block where it was a little bit safer. So we would find old milk crates, cut the bottom out, and nail it to telephone poles. So one day, me and a friend of mine were on our way to put a crate up. I noticed a man running. He stopped, and he fired into a house. As soon as he stopped shooting, we ran towards our house, which happened to be in the same direction of the bullets. As we were going down the block, we noticed a few guys coming up the opposite way of the block. They stopped and shot into that same house. As they were shooting, we had just passed the house. The bullets probably missed us by inches. We were probably 40, maybe 50 feet from home. We heard more shots. So there was another guy coming the opposite way, and he fired into that same house. My sister had a friend who actually was in that house during that time of the shooting. He got carried out, thrown into the back of a police car. He died on the way to the hospital. He didn't make it. And that was one of the most memorable times of my youth, something that has stuck with me my whole life, something that's made me wary of where I am, what I'm doing at all times. Fast forward maybe 12 years. I'm out of high school now. My high school sweetheart is pregnant with our first child. And a buddy of mine who had went away to college had called me one day and asked me to take a ride with him. 15, 20 minutes into the ride, he tells me where we're going. We're actually heading to a National Guard recruiting office. That had been the furthest thing from my mind was actually joining the military at the time. It was June 16, 2002, which was less than a year after 9/11. So now I made this decision, mind you, without talking to my family, my mother, my father, my girlfriend, who had just had my son. He was 7 months old. And I made this decision, and I said, sure. So less than a year later, got orders to go to Iraq. My job was locate, spot, and secure IEDs. IEDs are improvised explosive devices. They are explosives tied together with rudimentary wires and cell phone pieces. The enemy buries them on the road, waits for whoever to drive by, and he blows you up. For 12 to 14 hours a day for 2 years, this was my job. We rode up and down the road looking for roadside bombs, securing roadside bombs, getting blown up. Whatever they decided they wanted our unit to do, that's what we did. I was really angry while overseas. I didn't believe in the war. I didn't understand why we were over there in this place where no gunfire, there's nobody shooting at us. We're waiting for people to try to blow us up. We're in their country bullying them. That's how I seen it. I seen it as bullying. There was a lot of racism in my unit as far as towards the Iraqi people, which made me think, what did they say about me behind my back? That bothered me a lot. And my mother, she's been Muslim since I can remember. So seeing Muslim women over there and what they had to go through, it didn't always mesh well with me. That was something else that bothered me over there.
I was going to say, you know, you're talking about coming from a neighborhood mm-hmm. that clearly wasn't safe. Mm-hmm. Gunfire was a part of the reality. And then going over to war where the ground you walk on isn't even safe. How do you come back home and try to make a life after that? How do you have a sense of safety?
Well, a lot of jokes, I guess. Not too long after we got back, a buddy of mine was driving. While in Iraq, we never drove under bridges. Me and him were driving under a bridge. To make me feel better about going under this bridge, which I can't even explain how afraid I was to drive under this bridge at that time. I played a practical joke on him, which now thinking back on it, it wasn't nice, but it helped me get under that bridge. So I screamed IED, and we literally almost rolled the vehicle. It was a Jeep. And it's not funny, but it helped me. Coming from Philadelphia, like you said, there's a lot of shootings. I have family members who died, and I have friends that died. So gunfire wasn't something that would have been new to me over there. But like you said, now where can I drive? Where can I walk? So that was, I wasn't afraid so much so as just whatever's going to happen, let it happen. I wasn't suicidal, but it was like, if it's going to happen, then let it happen now. Let's go and see what comes from it. Because there's no rewind. I can't take back that I signed up. I can't get back the time I lost with my wife and my son. So I'm just going to go over here, do what I got to do, and try to make it back.
And thankfully, you did make it back. How's your life now?
Like I said, I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a brother, a son. I feel like my job now, what it means for me to be a black man, is to educate my son and my daughter and to show them that what the media says isn't who you are, what mommy and daddy say isn't, you know, that's not who you are. My job is to make sure that they go out and live life. So to me, being a black man is being a provider, a protector, and a loving parent and spouse.
So we've talked about, you know, the coding, and we've talked about difficulties and challenges. Let's talk about what binds the brothers together. Let's talk about what are the things that you guys share that bring you together, that, you know, what are the influences? Is it the music? Is it the religion? Is it the experience? Talk about that.
Well, I do think it is having those common experiences. So when I see another African-American man, no matter where we're, I mean, be in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, California, I know that that man has had very similar experiences to mine. I know he's had to do the code switching. I know that they're just some of those common experiences that you have that you don't even have to articulate it. You just know that that's the case. You can talk about it. It's like being in a club, right? Actually. It's a club, you know, and, you know, there's a way you shake hands and there's a way you do a lot of things that you just know. It's like, you know, I'm in a fraternity. I know, you know, the grip and, you know, it's sort of like that, you know, you know you're going to get that kind of reaction.
Yeah. You hit it right on the nose. There's a bond oftentimes that we share that, you know, like he said it, I don't have to know the person. When I met Mike, when he told his story, I understood him without him having to really get into his emotions or his feelings or anything other than him just telling his story. It was like, okay, I know this brother, you know, I know him. So it's almost like without even trying, we family without even trying. That's how I feel about it.
Let me give you an example. So when I hear about people witnessing certain kinds of violence or those kinds of things, I can't really relate to that. But the reality is, if I'm walking down the street at 10 o'clock at night with a PhD that I have, with, you know, the job that I have, all of those things, and the gentleman that you're listening to who've had a very different experience, we're going to be treated pretty much the same. That's the piece that I think binds us. There are some things that are common, and those things are the things that I think can connect folks in ways that, you know, that veterans or any other group that has a common experience can have.
What's the most infuriating stereotype that you've come across, and how would you rebuke it?
I would probably say that that black men, in terms of education, that we're not smart enough to learn, or we don't want to learn. That's something that bothers me, because I think there's, you know, there are layers to that in itself.
I'm going to tell you the one that I think is the most laughable, and that's the one that African-American men are lazy, right? And that one's funny to me, because I know guys who just work. They have multiple jobs. They work at home. They work in their church. They work. They just work. There's even, you know, the term, the John Henry syndrome. You know, you work yourself to death. So that one is just sort of juxtaposed to the reality. I think it's just kind of hilarious. And, you know, all groups have, you know, people that, you know, are lazy or whatever. But, you know, it's just not the typical. And one of the things that I try to do with certainly my kids and my family, is to point out when people don't fit the stereotypes. Because a lot of times, like when I'm walking down Market Street in Philadelphia sometimes, I'll see a young African-American father with two or three kids. And I wonder how many people really saw him taking care of his kids walking down the streets. Most people wouldn't see him.
He'd be invisible.
Completely invisible. I have this theory about the highly salient, invisible black man, because African-American men can be very invisible and highly salient at the same time. At night, at 10 o'clock on the street, you're very visible. If you're doing your fatherly duties in the middle of the day walking down Market Street, people aren't going to see you. And I think that that's just sort of the experience that people have. And so, you know, not putting it in people's face, but just politely pointing out, oh, that guy is, he looks like a really good father. Yeah. Did you see him?
Wow.
That's awesome. That's I got to do that. Because oftentimes, like I said, I'm an angry person. I've gotten a whole lot better. But I scream and fight for us so much online, at work. It's just like I said, like when I say it's a job, like that's what I mean. Because I feel like I'm always protecting us. When I see somebody not doing something, like, come on, man. You're like, you're not. You're setting us back, and it's not always that serious, but that's how I feel. And that was a great point he just made. That's why I was laughing. That was a great point.
So we've talked about African American males being fathers. All right, so let's talk about stereotypes about y'all as husbands, lovers, boyfriends.
We're awesome.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that.
Awesome. It's the only stereotype I've ever heard is that we're awesome. I mean, Dr. Evans over here.
You're preaching to the choir here. Okay.
We're done.
Well, no, not quite. You've been listening to Being a Black Man is a Full-Time Job here on Common Space. Our roundtable guests were Dr. Arthur C. Evans, Jr., Russell Walker, Michael Green, and Raheem Brock. The featured storytellers were Mr. Man Frisbee and Billy Smith. Common Space is a co-production of WHYY and First Person Arts, written by executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna and me, and produced by Mike Villers. Our theme music was written and performed by Subglow. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Check out all our podcasts at acommonspace.org, where you can also find information on how to tell us your story. Again, that's acommonspace.org. I'm your host, Jamie J, and remember, no matter what the news cycle brings, we'll be here at Common Space to help us all feel a little bit more connected to the world.